Commander Desmond Wilkie, Reel 3.
Well, our job was to go in first and to strafe the gun positions and the upper works of the Tirpitz to make them keep their heads down, reduce the amount of anti-aircraft fire while the Barracudas climbed a height and then dive-bombed. This we did. The attack was successful to some extent, but the trouble was by the time the Barracudas came down, the smoke was beginning to obscure the Tirpitz, and it was very difficult for them to find a good aiming point. Indeed, there were no more attacks were made because the weather clamped down, if I remember rightly. The weather got quite horrible. And so we came back to Ayr and Donabristol, and we went on leave. And then we came back and worked up for some more operations.
As you went into the attack, what time of day was it?
About 4 a.m. We took off at 0115, because it was July. It was light, you see. It was light all the time. And we took off about 1 o'clock in the morning. I suppose we attacked about 3 o'clock in the morning, because it was quite light.
How close to your Firefly did the enemy fire come, do you think?
Well, you can see it coming up. You can see Tracer coming up. The trouble is, Tracer doesn't look very dangerous, because it seems to come up so slowly. What you don't realize altogether when you're watching it is that between every Tracer there are six other bullets coming up at you. And, the machine guns are usually loaded, one Tracer, five armor-piercing, then another Tracer. So you only see the Tracer coming up, so you don't really realize exactly what weight of fire you're under. But certainly we could see the Tracer coming up. But we didn't lose the plane. In fact, the most difficult time was flying back. We had to cross over a fjord where a couple of destroyers were anchored. And they put up a very, very big anti-aircraft barrage, and we had to scoot past them pretty quickly.
Did the German Air Force come up?
No. There was an aerodrome there called Bardufoss, which was supposed to have some fighters, but they didn't interfere at all. There were submarines outside, and one of our carriers was torpedoed. It was an escort carrier was torpedoed. But the attack went very well, really, and paid. You know, all our training had paid off.
How frightening was it going into the attack?
Well, you know, fear is a funny thing. It's silly to say I wasn't frightened, but you don't think about it. You know, it's not gonna happen to you. Never does happen to you. You know, you're going to be all right. And the most frightening part of being a Fleet Air Arm Air crew is sitting on the deck waiting to take off. There's this terrific roar of noise, the carrier turns round into wind, and you're sitting there with the squadron around you, you know, and this is when you really think, you know, is this the last flight I'm going to do? But after that, you're too busy. You know, you're navigating, you're putting things on your chart, you're noting what you're looking, you're noting the time you go over certain headlands to make sure you know what your position is. And, you know, by and large, you're so busy, you haven't got time to think about the fear aspect of it.
Was there a sense of exhilaration when you got back?
Oh, yes. Too true. In fact, there's a sense of exhilaration while you're doing the attack. There's a sense of relief when you get back, too. And we didn't lose any aircrew, which was wonderful. You know, this was meant we could really celebrate.
Could you actually see the Tirpitz?
Yeah, we could, because we were first in. And the smoke had not yet obscured her, so we could see her. And my best recollection is of seeing an anti-aircraft battery on a platform in the cliff behind the Tirpitz being absolutely peppered with 20mm cannon shells.
Did the ship look impressive?
Not really. She looked big. But, you know, we've been doing this. We've been exercising. You know, we were used to looking at battleships, so... You know, she didn't form any great impression on us as being a stupendous thing. Because she was covered with netting, She really was quite difficult to see at times because she was camouflaged in part. She was painted with camouflage paint, and she wasn't very easy to make out. And in fact, we weren't looking at her so much as looking at the anti-aircraft batteries on the coast behind her.
Could you see the individual Germans manning the batteries?
No. Well, if I said yes, I think we could, but not clearly. They were how far away? 400, 500 yards away. Couldn't see them very clearly, but we could see the guns.
So they didn't run for it?
I don't think so.
What date in July did you say the attack was?
The attack was on the 17th of July.
I interrupted you with your saying that there were some other operations after the Tirpitz.
Well, after the Tirpitz, we came back, had some leave, did a lot... No, did we have some leave? No, we didn't. We had a lot more training. And then, on the 10th of August, we did some mine laying in the Leeds off Trondheim. We were escort for the Avengers. By then, the Barracudas had been replaced by Avengers, and we did some escort for those, and we shot up any flak ships which were in the Leeds, because the Avengers had to fly very low, very straight, and quite slowly to drop these mines accurately. We heard afterwards that it was quite a successful mine laying operation, that it did catch a couple of ships going up and down this route. The Leeds are the channels between the outer islands of Norway and the mainland. And that was mined. There were two trips we did. Both on the same day, I see. 10th of August, 44. And then we came back and did three more exercises on the target ship in the fjord in the north of Scotland. And on the 22nd of August, we went back and started on the Tirpitz again. And we did two operations on the 22nd of August, one on the 24th, and one on the 29th.
How did they compare with the first attack?
Well, they were less successful because by then the Germans had put in smoke pots all around the fjord. They put in a very good early warning system. And by the time we got there, the whole fjord was obscured by smoke. And indeed, after the second operation, I attended a meeting with the admiral who called the meeting to say, now look, what can we do about this? Can we, if we keep on alerting them, will they fire off the smoke pots and run out of smoke pots? But we didn't come up with a solution that meant, which ensured us a very good view of the Tirpitz. And this is what stopped us from doing a lot of damage. The Barracuda's got a couple of hits, but it wasn't a very successful operation as they go, because the Tirpitz was not put out of action. On the other hand, it frightened her enough for them to take her out of Carfjord and take her down towards Trondheim, and that was where the RAF got her, with the Lancasters. So there we were, and that was the 29th of August. We lost a plane in the mine laying in the Leeds. Des Viney and forget what the other chap was. They're buried in Norway. And in fact, one of our squadron members has been over there to see the people who look after the graves.
Did you see how it was lost?
No. It just didn't come back. From the mine laying. That, I think, was the first plane we ever lost. And then in September and October, we did a fair bit more training. And we eventually joined up with the carrier again at the end of November.
Was this to go out to the Far East?
To go out to the Far East, yeah. And we had, we were the Admiral ship, actually, and we had Vian join us, was going out there as the Admiral commanding aircraft carriers, Rear Admiral Sir Philip Vian. And he was a tough cookie, if you like. Our first memory of Vian is him having all the squadrons lined up in front of the bridge, and I think it was pouring with rain. Anyway, he stood in the shade of the bridge, not getting wet, while he talked to us. And you know, we thought, like, but if I may just take this a little farther, Vian was a man who just didn't like being in harbour. He didn't like not being on operations. I mean, he thought spending your time in harbour was a waste of time, waste of money, waste of the taxpayers' money. But on the other hand, Vian did one thing which made sure all the air crews were loyal to him. And in fact, we have revered him. And that was, a plane was shot down when we did some operations against Sumatra, not more than 10 or 15 miles from the coast. It was too dangerous to send a destroyer in to pick up the aircrew, so he took the fleet in to pick up the aircrew. And that was, I mean, after that, as far as the aircrew were concerned, Vian could do no wrong. He could bully us as much as he likes, as long as he looked after us when we came down in the drink.
How did you feel about going to the Far East again?
Well, I mean, we wanted to do our job, you know. We were trained. We trained a hell of a lot. We were going with four other carriers to make up a strike force, and we were very excited about it. Very excited about it. We trained all the way out, doing exercises. I got a list of here in my. We went to Ceylon. We went ashore to an aerodrome called Putlam, where we went on training, because the Americans said they didn't want us until we had put out of action the oil fields in Sumatra at Pankallan Brandon and Palembang. So we had very good models of these. We were, our job was to go in bottom front again to strafe certain key buildings, a pump house. I know we were told if we could put the pump house out of action, the whole thing would be out of action for months. So we had to identify that. We had an excellent model of it. The problem with the attack was that we had to fly off, climb to about 15,000 feet to cross a range of mountains, and Palembang was about 100 miles in from where the fleet was. So it was, you know, if the Japs had many fighters there, we were going to come under quite savage attack on the way in as well as during the attack. Anyway, we practiced this, and in fact, I very well remember that the exercise that we did was an absolute shambles. It didn't go very well. You know, we didn't form up very well, the planes didn't form up very well, and the whole thing didn't go very well. And we were a bit thinking, well, you know, I hope it goes better than this on the day. In fact, it did. And on the 4th of January, we did the attack on Pankallan Brandon, which is the first of the oil fields. It was called Operation Lentil. And this was the second time that we had trouble with barrage balloons, because the whole oil field is protected by barrage balloons. And on the way in, the flight commander in charge of the attack, a man called Major General Ronnie Hay, Major Ronnie Hay, a Royal Marine, who directed the attack from about 20,000 feet, told us to take on the barrage balloons and shoot them down so the Avengers would have a free run. And we shot down as many of them as we could, but they're not easy to shoot down, actually. You see, you puncture the thing and then they only float down, so you don't really know whether you've got rid of them until they go down. And we fired our rockets at this pumping station. But as a navigator, we were too busy looking out for jet fighters. And in fact, our plane was attacked by a jet fighter. It wasn't a particular, well, the attack wasn't pressed home that much because we had a lot of high-level cover who came down and had a dogfight with them. But nevertheless, it was we lost a fair number of crews. The Avengers lost a few crews, and we lost one crew, a chap called Danny Levitt, our senior pilot, and that was very sad, very sad.
What were these rockets that you had?
There were we had eight rockets. They had 60-pound warheads, 60-pound heads, and they were fired like a. They went very quickly, and they had quite a bomb on the front, you know, quite a bomb on the front, which would blow up and wreck machinery in a pumping station, things like that. They were a new weapon. They were particularly efficacious against submarines because they used a solid head, which pierced the submarine's casing, but they were also very good for ground attack. And I don't know who invented them, whether the Yanks did or we did. I have a feeling that we did. But they added a very another dimension to the capability of the Firefly, which was then a very good ground attack fighter, as well as long-range reconnaissance.
So that was Operation Lentil, you
said? That was Operation Lentil.
On the 4th of January?
On the 4th of January on Pankallen Brandon. Now then came a little adventure. On the way back to Ceylon, the fleet split up into two task forces to do exercises with each other. And the Fireflies were flown off from Indefatigable to do their primary fleet role, which was long-range reconnaissance. And it fell to Cheese and I to make the sighting of the enemy fleet. We sent back the enemy report. And then, more, I think, by luck than good judgment, the squadron took this message, so they all knew where the enemy fleet was, the exercise enemy fleet. And then we all closed in, and as luck would have it, we all closed in about the same time to strafe the flight deck, because there was a flight. There were planes on the Victorious, it was. And then Cheese and I stayed, and we shadowed for an hour and a half. That is, what you do is you take cloud cover, you get down very low, you go out, you come back in again. And eventually we were picked up by Corsairs. And always remember it very well, because eventually the Corsairs picked us up, which really meant that we'd failed, you know, we'd been picked up by the fleet we were shadowing and we'd have been shot down. But they kept on making passes at us. And Cheese fought the plane very well, because we had very good flaps, and you could go very slowly in a Firefly, actually, because you put your flaps down and go very slowly, so that the fighters had difficulty in getting a bead on you. And I always remember Cheese saying, "Go away, silly boys," on their frequency. And then they pushed off back. And then we started to fly back to the carrier. Now, got back to the carrier using my own navigation, I'm proud to say. Found the ships quite easily. In fact, I remember Cheese saying to me, "Is ETA, where's the fleet?" And I said, "There they are, down below you." "Oh," he said, "well done." So that was full marks. And then we'd been in the air then for 4.5 hours, and we were just about to land on, and a Spitfire crashed on deck, so we were waved off, and we ran out of petrol. Now, the saving grace was Major Cheeseman had been a Warris pilot, and there's a technique in landing a plane on the water, which you only know if you've flown a flying boat. You sort of motor in and hold the plane on its propeller, and motor it in tail down, so that the tail takes the first impact with the water, and then you sort of bounce like a bouncing stone. Anyway, really, Cheese did it so well that a destroyer called the Wakeful was alongside us before we even had to get out of the plane to get ourselves wet. And they threw down a climbing rope, and we went on the Wakeful. And we thought, now that's very nice, we're going to have a nice restful time until we get back to harbour. But not so. The Wakeful was ordered alongside Indefatigable. They put the crane over with an ammunition tray, and we got on this ammunition tray, and we were back on board our ship within an hour of forced landing in the water. Now, we went back to Ceylon, we did some more training, and on the 29th of January, we were on Operation Meridian, which was an attack on Palembang, which was another oil refinery. And we did that on the 29th of January and on the 2nd of March. And from then on...
What are your memories of that?
There were a lot more Jap fighters about. There were a lot more barrage balloons we had to shoot down. The discipline was very much better. The discipline, the radio discipline, there was not much chatter. The trouble with fighter pilots is they always want to be talking to someone. It's a lonely job, and they're always switching their radio on to talk to someone. And this stops anyone else sending vital information. But this time the radio discipline was very good. And it was a successful attack. I think the Japs didn't resume full production at Palembang ever, but it took them 6 months to get any kind of production out of it at all. So to that extent, the raids on Palembang and Pangkalan Brandon were successful. Can you stop? Anyway, after these operations in Sumatra, the squadron had a lot more confidence in itself. The whole fleet had a lot more confidence in itself. We really were sort of ready to go to the Pacific and help the Americans. Now, it's a matter of a record that the Americans didn't want us out there. Admiral King refused the offer of a British Pacific fleet and was forced by Roosevelt to take them. And they didn't want us, they wanted us to attack Borneo, they didn't mind what they attacked, as long as they didn't join up with them. But in fact, Roosevelt said, no, you will use this offer, this is a good fleet, and you will use them. So the terms were that we should under no circumstances have support, logistic support from the Americans. We would take our own logistic support. And we did our very best to take our own logistic support. But in point of fact, we really did have, and the Americans were very good to us. They knew that this was nonsense, that they could support us. And we had to prove to them that we were worth supporting. So after a short spell in Australia, where the people were absolutely wonderful to us, they welcomed us with open arms. And I still write to the people I stopped with in Australia. In Australia, this is, they really were very good to us. And anyway, we spent a little time there. We did a lot of working up, and then we went to a place called Manus, which was the rear base. There we picked up our oilers and fleet train, and then we went to Ulithi. Now this was the big shock. This was when we realised what small fry we were. We went into Ulithi. We were directed to an anchorage in a part of the atoll, and the rest of it was taken up with four large carrier fleets. There were about 30 carriers there of American compared with our four, and we then realized, if we hadn't realized it before, the Americans were in the big time, and we really had to prove ourselves to them. Now, we were given a job to do, we were up there for the invasion of Operation Iceberg, which was the invasion of Okinawa. And we were allocated the task of seeing that the Japanese did not stage any planes into Okinawa or to attack the American invasion fleets from the southwest, from Formosa. That was that there were some islands called the Ishigaki Jima in the Nanseishoto Islands. There were three airports there, and it was our job for 2 days out of every four to go in, to strafe them, to bomb them, to strafe the radar stations there, to strafe all the facilities there, to make sure that those airports were not used for staging planes in. And the Fireflies were used for escort to the Avenger bombers, for CAP, combat air patrols that was looking out, seeing that no planes came in to attack the fleet, and JAC patrols. Now, JAC patrols were very low level, about 30 miles from the fleet, and you flew up and down about 20 miles in the direction you expected attack. So that if the Jap kamikaze bombers came in low, you would give the fleet an early warning. And this was monumentally boring and monumentally tiring, because you had to, you know, you had to look. You were, after all, protection of the fleet. But on the other hand, you're just flying up and down, looking out. All you could see was the a destroyer, which was out there as a picket. And it really was. But it was very, very important. The other job we were occasionally given was what's called Dumbo Cap. Now, Dumbos were the submarines who were placed throughout the Pacific at strategic points to pick up ditching aircrew. And they always had a couple of fighters flying over the top of them to make sure the Japs didn't bomb them. And you know, they were long, long exercises. I've got one here, Dumbo Cap, 12th of April, 3 hours 50. Jack Patrol, 3 hours 30. When we did strikes against the Nancy Shoto, it was only a 1 hour 50 flight. But when we were on Jack Patrol with tanks on, with excess petrol tanks on, it was very, very long. But it was, you know, we realized how very essential it was. And we went on doing Operation Iceberg every 2 days back to refuel and then back again. And I think the Americans began to be glad that they had a fleet there. But they weren't really pleased that they had the fleet there until the kamikazes started attacking their fleet. And a kamikaze on an American carrier was a horrendous attack. The Franklin was burned down to the waterline. Because, you see, they had wooden flight decks. Now, we carried about 50% of the number of planes that one of their big carriers tried, but we had armoured flight decks. And eventually the Japs found us with kamikazes and attacked, and Indefatigable was the first one to be attacked. And I remember it very well. I remember the day very well. I was asleep, actually. I got up. We briefed a crew for takeoff. One of our crew was on the front of the carrier, ready for takeoff to do one of these jobs like Jack Patrol or Dumbo Cap or something like that. And I had flown, I think, late the previous night, and I was still getting up and shaving. And there was a bang, and this kamikaze hit the base of the island. It killed a Canadian doctor we were very fond of. It blew the bugler down the steps, and he broke his legs. It killed about two or three more people and put the operations room out of action. But it didn't put the flight deck out of action. Within half an hour, we had a barrier back in use, and we were landing on planes. Now, the American liaison officers we had were astonished at this. Absolutely astonished. They thought this was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And in fact, we had kamikaze attacks after that about every 3 days. And Victorious got hit, Formidable got hit. But in every occasion, we recovered very quickly and were landing on and firing off planes.